John chapter 13. It's good to see y'all this morning. Glad you're here. So we've studied the event of Jesus washing the feet of his disciples. And just the surprise of the disciples that here was the master. Here was their teacher who had prepared himself in such a way to wash their feet. Peter was the one that objected the loudest. We don't know if the others may have objected too, but it's recorded that Peter was saying, you know, Lord, you can't wash my feet. But Jesus, said to him, he said, first, what I am doing now, you do not understand, but you will know after this. And when Peter still objected, he said, if I do not wash you, you have no part of me. And Peter said, well, then don't just wash my feet, but wash all of me. But still, they don't really understand this. I mean, it was, as we discussed, it was a lesson. It was an illustration in servitude that Jesus was trying to teach in some way humility to his disciples. And there was reasons for that. There was purpose in that. But where we ended up Wednesday night in looking at the latter part of that reading, we had looked through and read through John chapter 13, verses 1 through 11. Or verse 10, Jesus said, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him, and therefore he said, you are not all clean. I think I said Wednesday night, I'm not totally positive all that says or implies, but I have some thoughts on that, and at the end, we very quickly talked about some things about ceremonial cleaning. But I do think the text is talking about more than just ceremonial cleaning, and we didn't really get to discuss that so much. And I want to spend just a moment, on that. So we just read John 13 and verse 10. In the text, it would seem that at least for one thing, Jesus is referring to a figurative or a ceremonial cleaning. And we might recall that the children of Israel, from the earliest times when they would approach the Lord, that there would be a consecration or purification process that they would go through, before drawing near the Lord. And it would have been that when these Jews came to Jerusalem, for the Passover, which was their purpose of being there, that they would have purified themselves, that they would have made themselves ceremonially clean, that they would have washed. I can imagine they would have washed their clothes. They would have, washed their bodies. Well, if they still had a little bit of journey going into the city or wherever they're going, they still might need to wash their feet. And I've wondered if that is in part what Jesus was inferring here, that they had purified themselves or ceremonially cleaned themselves. And in that way, he says, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you. And that leads to the next statement when it says that he knew who would betray him. Speaking of Judas, of course. Well, I'm sure Judas had gone through the same process of purification. He had been consecrated. I'm sure he had bathed himself. But yet Jesus was still saying, not all of you are clean. And so it has something to do more than just the ceremonial cleaning. There was something else to that. Let's talk about that for a moment. Now, here's some things we looked at Wednesday night, just very briefly going over this for those who are not here. In and around Jerusalem were multiple opportunities and places to go to become ceremonially clean before the feast, where they could wash and purify themselves in that way. We're looking at a picture we've looked at before, a model of the city of Jerusalem in the first century. And in our stories, as we've read through and studied through the book of John, we've talked about the pool of Siloam, the healing that took place there, and then there's up here the pool of Bethesda. I'm trying my best to say. or Bethesda. No, that's Bethesda. And we'll get it. But in and around the city would have been other places where there would have been cleansing that could have taken place. And just take note here so we get our bearings straight on this. This is the old city of David, of course, the Temple Mount. Here are the steps or the stairs that lead into the double gate. Over here you see Wilson Arch, as it has been called. Just pointing out some places that when we take a closer look, you know, again, we're seeing the steps that go up to the south wall and Wilson Arch, as it is here. And we draw a little bit closer, and we're looking now straight across that's the southern wall, that's the west wall going that way. And we want to kind of look at this corner because we're going right down here in just a moment. We're going down to that corner. Of course, over here would be the steps going down, you know, from the double gate. And just a point of interest, some have asked, what, you know, is that part of the temple? No, that's part of a mosque. Because this corner right here is this part of the Temple Mount is, you know, it's the Muslim quarter. And that's one of the mosques that's there. And as we mentioned, you know, like Jerusalem is the third most holy site among the religion of Islam, behind Medina and Mecca. And so that's why there's such a large pilgrimage to Jerusalem each year for that. And so now we're down here at a lower level, looking at that same corner. Here's the remnants of that Wilson Arch. And looking along the west wall, here's where the Jews would, they meet daily for their prayers against the wall. You see them on TV sometime, they're, you know, next to the wall saying their prayers. Well, down there at that corner, this is part of the old street that would have been there in the first century, getting our bearings, and right here through these gates, or I'm not sure what to call them, but these gates, if you look back in this area here is where we are going. Just outside the city wall, we go through these gates, and here's one of those ceremonial pools. In fact, there's more than one right there. And if you go around, you know, here's just some other looks at mikvah, is what it would be called in Hebrew. And it was one of the places where the Jews would do their ceremonial washing. This is inside looking out, and well, up there's the remnants of that Wilson Arch we were talking about. So you know where we are as far as the city wall goes. But just outside of the double gates and down those stairs in front, well, there's another pool right here that would have been used for ceremonial cleaning. And just a little bit farther down from that, you know, are some other pools that would have been used for the same purpose. And in and around Jerusalem, there, some have said over 100 of these pools like this that would have been used for ceremonial cleansing. But now going back to some discussion that we didn't really get to have Wednesday night, was, you know, maybe the bigger picture of the text here. We can talk about cleaning or cleansing in a physical sense, a ceremonial sense, in a spiritual sense too, all of which might be implied in the text. Jesus demonstrated a physical cleansing when he washed the feet of his disciples. Of course, that was for a purpose of teaching. He was trying to teach, you know, humility. No one is too good to serve. And he was trying to help his disciples understand that they need to be in a place or a position of service. I mean, there could have been some bragging among them. Well, in fact, there was very likely some bragging among them about who's the greatest and who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And that may have even increased after the death and the resurrection of Jesus, as they became even more known as the ones who had walked with the Lord. And he's trying to tell them they're nobody special, but that they need to demonstrate the work of service. Jesus did that when he physically cleansed their feet. He washed their feet. Well, then there was as well, we talked about the ceremonial cleaning that could be referred to here in the text, the preparation of the Passover. That was part of obedience to the law. But then the last point, and we didn't talk about this Wednesday night, was the idea of spiritual cleaning. Because when Jesus made this comment, you know, you are not all clean. Well, I can only believe they're eating the Passover. They have all been ceremonial cleansed. They've been to one of the pools. They have cleansed themselves. They have washed their clothes. They have all been cleansed that way. And so when he says, not all of you are clean, how so? They've all been cleansed. Well, and when it comes to physically being cleansed, he even washed their feet. He says, if you've been cleansed, all man must do now, if you've bathed, all you have to do now is wash your feet. Well, he's done that too. And so they've been ceremonially cleaned. They have had their feet washed. And so there's not a physical cleanliness issue or a ceremonial cleanliness issue that's being considered now. but one of them was not clean. How so?
11 of them had pure motives. One had a bad motive.
And you can't wash that off in the pool. It doesn't matter how many times you wash your clothes to be purified. If your heart is not right, you're still unclean. And I tend to think that's the reference that the Lord was making at that point. Because the other cleansing had taken place. And yet, because there was a heart issue, there was one who was not clean. And so I think that's kind of a standout point. I mean, Jesus had taught, as did the old law, that we must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And there were some here of the disciples who had already said that they would follow the Lord to death if that's what it required. But not all of them were willing to do that. Judas was just hours away from betraying the Lord. And the Lord knows that. I can imagine this too. It's got to be overwhelming. And yet, the next few hours are not going to allow time for reflection. Because, the next five chapters, you know, are the hours before the crucifixion. And before the Lord was betrayed and taken away from them, which is basically the next five chapters, he has a lot to tell them. He has a lot that he's trying to share with them in this short period of time because his time with them is now, you know, so very short. So that's some of the things that I've had in mind when I've considered, you know, what did Jesus say? Or what did he mean when he says there's still one who's not clean? I think that's the idea. But then he goes on here, you know, in verse 12, the story continues, and it's still about the disciples haven't got over this foot washing yet, which maybe leads us to some other thoughts and some other questions that may very well come up. In verse 12, we read, "So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them.'" Well, I think at least on a surface level, it brings up a couple of questions. One that stands out, are we supposed to be washing each other's feet? Some have really debated that. Some believe that, in fact, that that's to be so. And so you have to stop and think about this for just a moment here. What is the point? What is the lesson that Jesus is trying to teach? You know, what was his purpose? And what does that mean to us? Now, a couple of things here to kind of get our thoughts going and our conversation where it needs to be. I'm thinking one of the first things we have to understand is what was the mind or the attitude of the disciples up to when it comes up to this point? Jesus has just taught a tremendous lesson in humility. Why was he stressing the need of humility so much among his closest associates? Why did he see that need? They had a problem with it, indeed. They had a problem with it, even among themselves. You know, a couple of passages here on your outline, we're on page 42 now. In Matthew chapter 20, and verse 20, we begin reading. Here's the disposition of the apostles and and even family of some of the apostles. Matthew 20 and verse 20. And then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something of him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" And she said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left hand, in your kingdom." But Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am to be baptized with?" And they said to him, "We are able." And he said to them, "You shall indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am to be baptized with. But to sit at my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is those for whom it is prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to be greatest among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." This is one of the lessons of Jesus to his disciples about, you know, you have to strive to be greater servants. It's not about who can be brought into a position of prominence. If you want to lead, you have to serve. So we can see this caused some strife among the disciples here. But in Luke 22, the picture becomes even clearer to me. In Luke chapter 22, if you'll look there with me, Luke 22 and verse 24. "But there was also strife among them, which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, 'The king of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be the younger, and he who is the chief, as he who serves.'" You know, it was the same story. It was the same kind of lesson. I mean, this was one of those things where I don't know to what degree there was strife, but the fact that there was strife tells us that even among these apostles, you know, they were debating and bickering among themselves about who's going to sit next to the Lord, who's going to be in a greater position of authority. And so now as time goes on and the hours of the Lord with his disciples are coming to an end, he teaches the lesson of humility. And he, the one who is the master, the one who is the chief, the one who is the Son of God, they all know that and believe that now. There was none who could be above the Lord, and he was the one who washed their feet. That's why he taught this lesson of humility. Going to require a service.
He was preparing them for the work to be done after his ascension.
Absolutely.
Because of his selfless job.
Absolutely. They would be nothing but servants. There's some lessons here for us in this as well. But still, there's a question. You know, and this is a serious question. I mean, people might bring this up when you think about Jesus teaching this lesson of humility and how he has just said, you know, wash each other's feet, you know, is what he has told them to do. What is the lesson that we need to learn? I mean, we've beat up on the apostles now, you know, because of their attitude and unwillingness, it seems, to serve one another. But what's the lesson that we need to learn? Well, there's a lesson of humility and servitude that's being taught to us. But the question that comes up with some is that, well, are we supposed to wash each other's feet? Well, on one hand, I would say, yes, we are, but not in a physical sense. I don't think that was the point. But let's understand where some people are at on this. I mean, here's what some would say. They would say, well, here's the text that you go to that tells us that we are supposed to literally wash each other's feet. And there are some who would have a part of their worship service, you know, days where there is foot washing that takes place. And some have connected that to the Lord's Supper as well. You know, because since Jesus and the disciples had gathered on that day, you know, for the Passover, we don't remember the Passover now because that was the old law, but we remember the Lord's death when we eat the Lord's Supper. And so they will have special occasions where there is foot washing and where there is the remembrance of the Lord's Supper. And what they would turn to is passages like we've just read here in John chapter 13, you know, that Jesus, of course, washed the feet of his disciples, and he said, you should do this to one another. So, of course, we should do that too. And so we have to think about that a moment. Is that what we're supposed to do? And they would turn to passages we know in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, you know, as a record of the Lord instituting the Lord's Supper, and say, you see, these are things that are supposed to happen together. And so you have to wonder and think a little bit about how do you deal with that? How do you answer that? Because it's not a small number of religions today that would have feet washing at some point in their service from time to time. Some would go so far as in their marriage ceremony, the new groom and the bride washing each other's feet to demonstrate humility, I guess, and servitude to each other. I mean, I understand the point of that. But is that what we're supposed to be doing? I mean, if that's what we're supposed to be doing, we should be doing that. And so how do you deal with that kind of an issue? Is that what the text is saying? Because, I mean, what we have to think about, I mean, some would say spiritual foot washing in love is necessary in church life for maintaining a pleasant fellowship with the Lord and the saints. Now, what would you think if I told you I agree 100% with that statement? What would you think? The key to my statement on that is spiritual foot washing is necessary. When we look at this in a spiritual sense, the idea of what Jesus was teaching was servitude and demonstrating our love and concern to our brothers and sisters in Christ. I agree with that point. But are we supposed to physically watch each other's feet to demonstrate that? What would you say? I mean, how would you answer that? Because there are some people very serious about physically washing each other's feet. They believe that Jesus taught that. They would go to this text to make their point. That's their proof. How would you answer that?
I had a preacher to tell me that if you came to his house, he would wash your feet.
Physically so.
Physically, yeah.
Okay.
In his house. And you would know who I'm talking about if I mentioned this.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. One of the things I think we have to take into account is the fact that if we all wore sandals and had to walk a large distance to get here across the dusty path, we probably would need to do this. But we're not doing that now. We've washed, we've put socks and shoes on, we got into a car, we rode here. We didn't get our feet very dirty getting into the building.
Okay, let's make a point with that, because there's something to be said to that. The fact that foot washing took place in that time and before and after that, you know, that's a fact. There's not an argument we would make against that. They did that, of course. In consideration of whether a widow should be taken under the care of the church, one who is indeed a widow, as 1 Timothy chapter 5 would teach, one of the things that is said about her is, here is a woman who has done many good works. She has brought up children. She has lodged strangers. She has washed the saints' feet. I imagine that was literally so. She has demonstrated in all the characteristics that's described, she's being a servant in every way. So indeed, there would have been literal foot washing that day. Of course, that has no reference at all to any spiritual connotation. It was just a service that you would do when strangers or when friends came to your house. It was a kindness that you would do. And so some might turn to that passage and say, see, look, there was foot washing. No argument there. Yes, there was foot washing. Of course there was. But does that make it a part of our worship to God? Is it something we should be doing today?
Most of the time, when the service was done, who did it? If there were servants in the house,
yeah,
the servants did it.
The lowliest did that.
And that's the lesson here.
That the greatest did it as opposed to the lowliest. Yeah. There's a lesson that comes with that too.
You pointed out a minute ago that Jesus was making a transition from talking about the physical old law, mm-hmm, ceremonial cleansing, and moving it into a spiritual argument,
yes,
about cleansing. And I think his argument continues.
I do too.
As he is describing this foot washing, it is a spiritual thing. It is
it's a heart thing.
A relationship, mm-hmm, between fellow,
sure,
Christians.
Sure.
You need to do this with one another. You need to help them where they need help. You need to strengthen them. You need to cleanse them where they need cleansing.
In the heart. That's it. So, Gina, I think that says some things very well about what has just happened and how we have to see the passage. It was a hard issue that he was trying to teach. He was trying to teach servitude. He was trying to teach lowliness to his apostles, even among those who were arguing among themselves who was the greatest. That was the lesson that he was trying to teach. He was trying to tell his disciples, instead of arguing among yourselves who is the greatest, instead of telling you should wash each other's feet. That was the farthest thing from their mind. I mean, they were positioning themselves for a great place in the kingdom, is what they were doing. And this was just as far from their mind as it could be. And so the point of the lesson here was that of humility. Now, to the argument that some say, well, of course, then we should be doing that today. And I would agree to the standpoint that from a spiritual sense, we all must learn to be servants, and we must wash each other's feet in that way. Humble ourselves in such a way that we are willing to serve. That's what Jesus has been talking about. It's the spiritual lesson that is there. If there was some spiritual ceremony that had to take place with this, if it's something that should be a part of our service, if it's a part of our worship in some way, where's the evidence? I mean, if there were just one example after the establishment of the New Testament church that this was to be a part of our service and worship when we come together, then we would have a very different view of this, I think. But there is no evidence of that. I mean, there's nothing that's commanded. There's no example of that in any way. The only thing that we find is that 1 Timothy 5 passage I read a moment ago, where of the widow indeed had demonstrated servitude in all aspects of her life, even washing the feet of strangers. And that's the only thing that we would find. So do I think it's supposed to be a part of our service? Well, no, there's nothing. There's no evidence of that in any way.
But to me, it's kind of like teaching this is the least you can do for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're in Africa and you find somebody that's starving to death and you start washing their feet, does that get them anywhere?
Right, yeah, right.
Or if they need Jesus,
right,
do they need their feet washed? They need
exactly
Jesus?
Exactly. Good point.
Well, all
good
of this took place among his apostles. There.
Yes.
He didn't go out into the public plaza and wash.
Very true.
The general public's feet.
Nor do we see the apostles going out after Christ in doing that or teaching that as something that would be done.
I think the example that we have is in our song service.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
encourage. Sure. Or to.
It's a spiritual.
For those who are strong to lift up those who have fallen down. You know, we find many other means and examples of how we would encourage the weak. I saw another hand somewhere.
I think one of the things that for us today, the lesson that we might see is when we come together as a church or a congregation and we elevate some to positions and then make them special.
Right, right.
That's probably where the lesson needs to be. They need to be able to go and be a servant in
right.
that congregation, as
right.
well as being the Almighty within that congregation.
Sure.
And this is something that the apostles were sort of looking at. Where do I come into ranking? How can I rank higher?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to be careful of that in our day-to-day worship services and in our local congregations, that we don't start vying for that position. Where I get to wear the
right.
robe, I get to wear the big cross,
mm-hmm.
I get to stand on the elevator.
And we see that so much in the denominations that way. And if we're not careful, it's an attitude that sneaks in with us sometimes too. Neil, would you have your hand? Relax. I knew it was a hand here.
This is a very consistent message throughout the life of Christ from
sure.
his birth. Here we have the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the Maker of heaven and earth, comes down and is born not in a palace or a castle or mansion, but rather in a barn, you know, and is laid in a feeding
sure.
trough. From that point,
from the beginning of his life to the end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, his first big sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, begins, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they that mourn, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
Mm-hmm.
The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. This illustration here, many, many other things that Jesus did, flip the Gentile, the model of greatness upside down, if you were to think
mm-hmm.
about it.
Right.
As a pyramid, you know, their great ones were on the top.
Right.
And
exactly.
And down from there. And then
he turned it
Jesus
over.
Jesus flipped the pyramid upside down.
Yeah.
And said that the one who would be greatest of all would be servant of all. And Jesus, of course, was the perfect example of that.
That's right. That's a good point. Good. All right. Right. Sure.
Even if you're in charge of something, you shouldn't ask your people to do anything that you wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good thoughts. Well, spend a little bit of time kind of working our way through that, but how often do you actually go through John 13 and talk about foot washing? I thought we needed to kind of slow down and give some thought to that. And while maybe that isn't, maybe it's not an issue to us in our thinking in any way, with some, understand that it is, that some would seriously wonder and question if physical foot washing needs to take place. And I don't think we see that, you know, as part of the service of New Testament Christianity. But you have to stop and think about that stuff. And so as the text goes on, as the story here goes on, you know, we take up here about verse 18, where now the storyline is changing just a little bit, and it's going to be turning more to the idea that Christ knows, okay, we're coming right to the end, and identifying Judas as the betrayer. And we need to notice that the disciples, they don't really see that yet. I mean, sometimes we forget, I mean, we've read the whole story. We know how it's going to come out. And the apostles, they still don't get this. They're still just not understanding that Jesus is truly going to go to the cross here in a few hours, and that one of them, one of that close circle, is going to be the one who betrays the Lord. And so we begin reading in verse 18. Jesus is speaking. I do not speak concerning all of you. I know whom I have chosen. But that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. Now I tell you before it comes, that when it comes to pass, you may believe that I am he. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send, it receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit, and he testified and said, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom he loved. Simon Peter therefore nodded to him that he should ask who it was of whom he spoke. Then leaning back on Jesus' chest, he said to him, Lord, who is it? And Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. And after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Then Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. So again, you try to picture the apostles as they are seated together, having eaten the Passover. And to keep in mind that traditionally they would have been sitting at a very low table. It sounds a little peculiar here that, you know, there was one leaning on the chest of Jesus. Well, they were all sitting and probably leaning on their arm, so to speak, and as they ate together. John, I think, was probably the one that was closest to him. John's name, we mentioned this from the beginning of our study. John's name is never really called out in the text. He doesn't identify himself. But by other times, and other times, particularly in the last chapter, you know, the way the text is written, it helps to identify who the writer is as John, and that John perhaps is that disciple whom the Lord loved. He was one of the ones who was closest to the Lord. And so it was he who was sitting next to the Lord, and when Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me, it was Simon, maybe sitting across the table, that nodded at John like, go ahead, ask him who. And John asked that, you know, Lord, who is it? And Jesus identified, it's the one to whom that I give bread after I have supped. And he gave that to Judas. Now, I still don't know that the apostles fully understand what's about to happen. But Judas has been identified. Now, again, you have to just think for a moment about what Jesus was thinking or feeling at this point. I mean, he is hand-to-hand with his betrayer as he identifies him. And he knows what's going to happen and says to John, whatever you're going to do, just go do it. Let's get this done. And here Judas is going to leave them. I mean, this is just an incredibly emotional time as these things here are unfolding. And so Judas is identified. Your comments or thoughts?
Satan or any of his demons. He is in complete control over all things. And when he hands him the dipped bread and he eats it, Jesus consistent with Judas's own plans. He's already planned to do this.
And yeah, his deed is already done. He's already made the deal at this point. And so it's good points here, good comments. It's not as though all of a sudden Satan is just taking over his heart now. Judas had already made the deal. And you know, the Lord is just saying, just go do this. And Satan has fully infiltrated the heart of Judas at this time, at this point. Good thoughts. Okay, our time is gone. We've gone a little bit.